So I'm in Brussels, Belgium. Before this interview, I interviewed Ricardo Cygnus, the current profile maintainer. It was an interesting talk. And now we have Larry Wall, creator of Perl, and among other things.
Hello.
Is this the first FOSDEM for you?
Yes, I am a FOSDEM virgin.
Yeah, same for me. How do you find the conference in the city?
The city is quite interesting. I've been in Belgium before, but never managed to get into Brussels. The only thing that bothers me about the city is I grew up in cities where all the streets go north, south, and east and west. And so everything's at an angle here.
Yeah.
FOSDEM, it's amazing how well it works for being so self-organized. They're not mostly not professionals running this. It's almost all volunteers, and yet it runs quite smoothly.
Yeah. There's no even registration, and most of the dev rooms, Perl dev rooms, Ruby dev rooms, Python rooms, all self-organized by the volunteers from the community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this afternoon, we're recording this on Sunday, February 1st in European time. And this afternoon, you gave a kind of like keynote style talk mm-hmm. in this conference.
Yeah, so I couldn't make it to OSCON this year. So I was kind of thinking this is a state of the onion speech that had been delayed by 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also very exciting because we've recently come to the conclusion that we can probably get an official, for some definition of official and production ready version of Perl 6 out by the end of this year.
Mm.
So our old joke about Perl 6 will be out by Christmas, we won't say just which one it is. We're speculating heavily that this is going to be the actual Christmas it comes out. So that's exciting news. And we're certainly hoping that we can follow through on that. But
yeah, so the announcement you made was by September this year, your birthday, you get a public beta preview for Perl 6. And
yes.
By Christmas this year, you get the first production release of Perl 6.
Yes, there are a few speculative things that we need to experimentally put in early in the year, and then toward the end of the year we need to settle things down and make sure all the bugs are fixed and that we've sorted out all the tests into the ones that we actually want to support for 6.0 and the ones that we want to put off for the future. So we're it's been a long time coming that we could see that everything was converging on a solution, but we just didn't know how fast it was converging. And now it looks like we can have something that'll be pretty generally useful. It probably won't run quite as fast as Perl 5 on everything. There's some things that'll run faster than Perl 5, but in other areas it's still lagging. But that'll come with time.
Yeah. I think the original announcement for Perl 6 was in 2000.
Yes, in July of 2000. Yes.
So it's been 15 years of development.
Almost. Yes. In my talk today, I compared that with the amount of time that Tolkien took to write his sequel to The Hobbit, which, was the Lord of the Rings. And that one came out okay, even though it took so long. So we're hoping that we can kind of follow in Tolkien's footsteps.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Perl 6 is obviously a second system syndrome, but this time it's a different mistake you're making.
Yeah, well, we had a long list of mistakes that we knew about Perl 5, so we weren't going to make those ones again. We knew that we were changing, intentionally from the start. We said, if we're going to break things, let's break everything that needs to be broken, which is, how you get second system syndrome. And we even knew that. but we chose it intentionally because, you know, the problem with second system syndrome, if you try to do it in a company, you have a burn rate and you're paying employees and overhead and you've got to get customers, pretty soon or the revenue stream dries up.
Yeah.
With a volunteer organization that is just working on it as they can, you can stretch it out. And because of that, I mean, that's essentially what Tolkien did too. I mean, he just stretched out his writing until it was done. And that's actually how you do second system syndrome right. And so our slogan is second system syndrome done right. As long as you eventually come to a solution, then hopefully that's a happy resolution of the problem.
Yeah. So when you look back this 15 years of development, what kind of mistakes do you think the development has made? Can you talk about a little some of the examples or specific?
Well, we probably separated the roles a little too much at the beginning between language design and implementation. That's only partly my fault. When we started off, they said, well, we need a language designer because we can't agree on how to change the language, but we don't want you involved in the implementation because we already saw how you programmed Perl 5 and we didn't like it. I stayed far enough away from the implementation that I probably did not have sufficient oversight of some of the ways things were going wrong in the early stages. So, and the project itself, you know, I'm not a good manager. I'm much better at language design than managing people. I'm so bad at delegating that I even delegate the delegating to other people. And unfortunately, some of the early programming, we ended up with a parrot that was too large for pretty much anyone to understand completely and understand how to refactor it. So, while that was going along slowly, we had several other implementations attempted. First was Pugs, and that was very useful to try to implement Perl 6 in a very strict language that would force us to decide what the exact semantics of various parts of it would be. But even more than that, that's when we started getting a test suite. Pugs was, Audrey said, you give me tests, I'll write code. And that worked quite well for a while. Eventually that project kind of fell apart. We did learn a lot from that. Later on down, we had another project called Niecha, which was an implementation of Perl 6 on top of .NET, CLR, and Mono. Okay. That actually was quite speedy a good proof of concept that we could put Perl 6 on other VMs. Some of the decisions we made about garbage collection and those turned out to be good decisions. Unfortunately, that project, we also learned, that certain ways of assuming how you structure the internals don't really work right. So it turned out that Rakuto on top of Parrot, about the same time, they were deciding that they wanted to be to have Perl 6 on many different VMs as backends. And so they chose to create an intermediate portability layer, which they called NQP, which is not quite Perl. So it's a subset of Perl 6, which is more easily portable and has simpler semantics, but is quite a bit harder to program in and is quite unforgiving if you make mistakes. It is fairly easy to port. So they first officially ported it to the JVM. And at the same time, they were kind of secretly working on a new VM called MoreVM. And now JVM and MoreVM implementations are fairly comparable. The MorVM implementation starts up very fast compared to JVM anyway, and runs quite fast and has the sort of type specialization and just-in-time optimizations and inlining that same sort of things that are happening in JVM as well that cause the program to optimize itself over time, and that seems to work out quite well for a language such as Perl 6, especially with the gradual typing that we have at the high level.
Does the JVM backend have a special name for it?
It's just Rokudo JVM or Rokudo More or Rokudo Parrot. And so far we've been also maintaining the Parrot backend, but there's some historical code in there that's a lot of conditional compilations that are not very pretty, and so that's why I told the implementers that this year, if they needed to, they could sort of neglect that backend in order to get more VM out by the end of the year, you know, and somebody may well pick that up and carry forward that work if someone is interested in doing that. The JVM is more likely to track closely, because I think we have a little more interest in people wanting to run on top of the JVM.
Yes, for sure. So when you say 6.0 release by Christmas, is that going to be Rokudo with the more backend?
That will be Rokudo with the more VM backend, yes.
Okay. This conference, yesterday, Curtis Obido, he gave a talk at Perl 6, and you gave a keynote at the big auditorium, and looks like the attention gets to a lot of attraction here. Do you feel about
it's
that?
It's definitely, we're getting more interest now as we get closer to something that is useful and stable and more well understood. You know, more people are getting excited about it, and we're having in Ovid's session yesterday, it was standing room only. We actually were kind of cheating on the room full rules there, and in fact it was already full, and I had to come in late, and I saw the room full sign. I said, yeah, I better go in anyway. It was a good thing, because I had to answer some questions too.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we're quite gratified to see the interest, and I'm glad that Curtis was able to sort of present the simple end of Perl 6, because those of us who have you know, been working with it for so long, are excited about showing off the really fancy stuff, and it's a good thing to have someone worrying about the learnability end of it too.
So he explained the Perl 6 for regular people, maybe you could say.
He was trying to stick to the stuff that doesn't look scary.
Yeah, you showed the in other Perl conferences like YAPC in North America, you showed more hands-on coding for Perl 6 with like a demo. And today you did only a couple of those.
Yeah, I did a couple of those. It was more or less just a teaser. The talk was more about the philosophy and the history of the whole thing, and to indicate some of the inspiration in my thinking. And what brought me to here, but also you know, how the Perl community acts a lot like the companions in the Lord of the Rings, and supports each other along the way, and they all take turns goofing up and taking the lead and helping each other out. So it seemed like a good metaphor to talk about. But yeah, I just gave a few teasers. Ovid, yesterday, he was, I mean, it was not just the small end of the language that he was presenting, the easy end, but he did a really good job of showing how clean the semantics are of Perl 6, in especially in numerics. We've done a lot of thinking and talking about how to make things behave the way normal people expect. So if you add some fractions, it tries to do it exactly the way a person would expect, not the way someone who's gotten used to floating point numbers would expect.
Yeah, so you mentioned the role, your role at the community is the language designer. And what's the size of the Perl 6 community today, and what kind of people are leading this effort and implementations?
Most of the activity is centered on the IRC channel, Pound Perl 6 on Freenode. On any given day, there's usually about 200 people attached to that channel. Of course, some of them are lurkers. Some of them are bots. the actual active developers is a fuzzy set. But, on any given day, we might have, 10 or 15 people actually working on things in different areas. The various low-level operations in the VMs or documentation or tests debugging and experimenting with the higher level language. An interesting activity that happens almost every day is that someone will get an error message, and we will look at that and we will say it is LTA, which means less than awesome. And so one of our many goals is to get rid of all the messages that are less than awesome and replace them with awesome error messages. So we worry a lot about how things go wrong, not just about how things can go right.
I remember the early days of our Perl 6 development, there was the RFC process, and Damien Conway was writing down a bunch of articles about how things should behave. And are those RFCs still the design principle?
Well, they're not so much the design principles as the indicators of pain. we looked at those RFCs. I expected about 20 of them, and we got 361. And it actually, set me back on my heels for 6 months while I just, thrashed mentally until I, kind of figured out an order to start thinking about them. But it was obvious after reading through them all that there was no way that these taken together would present a coherent design. Each of these RFCs, they sort of looked at a problem in isolation with blinders on and said, well, let's just fix this one thing, and here's how we would do it. And so if we'd done all those things, it would have just been a complete hodgepodge, a mess. And so we had to, back off and basically throw out all the solutions they proposed and say, what are the underlying pain points? What's the cry for help here? And then start to unify the start looking for unifications of and principles that were behind why people were hurting. And once we did that, then we started seeing themes like a lot of these RFCs were a direct result of having a sloppy type system. So we started thinking, what sort of a type system should we have? And should we allow programmers to continue to think sloppily about their programs? And we actually decided, there are lots of ways in which it's fine for a programmer, especially a new programmer, to be sloppy in the thinking. What's not fine is if the computer is sloppy in thinking about it. So with Perl 6, the user might not really quite be aware whether a particular variable contains a number or a string, and it'll interconvert it for him. But the computer very much knows what the actual declared type of it is. So that makes it much clearer what the semantics are. And there were other, you know, other unifying themes that we detected on many different levels. And so just over time, we found designs that fixed a lot of the surface issues that people were complaining about, and often fixed them on a deeper level than they had suggested fixing them.
So is a type system, is that called gradual typing? Is that what you mentioned?
Yes, we call it gradual typing. Basically, you can write code with that is typeless as you would write most Perl 5 code or lots of other dynamic languages. But as you add type declarations, these type declarations actually take effect at compile time and inform the compiler as to the intended uses. And this has several beneficial effects. Probably the least important is what people call strong typing. We can enforce certainly some of the type constraints at compile time, but most of them are enforced at runtime. The second reason for doing it is that it gives the compiler much more information to optimize with. So if you know the types that can or cannot be stored in a particular variable or structure, then you can optimize the representations of that and the processing of it. But really what it turned out to be the most important thing was have a system that's called multiple dispatch, sometimes called multi-method dispatch, but we also have multiple dispatch on subroutines, on functions as well. And if you write your a set of functions that all have the same name but differ in the type signatures of their parameters, then it will automatically dispatch to the correct subroutine or method. And this can fill in for what in older languages you'd use switch structures for, but it's much more extensible because you can just add more multi-methods or multi-functions as you go along, and it all just works together in an appropriate way. And so that's really the most important reason for having the stricter types underlying, is that we can very clearly decide whether we should dispatch to the one with arguments that are numeric, or the ones that are arguments that are strings, or whatever other object types you're dealing with.
So the language knows the clear semantics of the types. And
yes, in Perl 5, you could change the type of a scalar by observing it, and we decided this was a bad idea. It's okay if a scalar sort of object, when you coerce it to something else, if it caches the coercion so it doesn't have to do it again, that's just an optimization.
Yeah.
But if it then actually takes a value that you really ought to be considered immutable and mutates it, then you're starting to get into trouble. And especially if you were relying on the type of it before and suddenly the type changes, then you're just hosed.
Yeah. Okay. So when you ship 6.0 probably and by Christmas this year, what's coming after that?
Well, maybe we'll take a long vacation. I know. I suspect that we will have to negotiate that when we get there. It may become obvious after we've sorted out the various tests into pre-6.0 and post-6.0, what the next thing to work on is. That would be difficult to predict.
Yeah. Well, I guess nobody, you mentioned in the talk that nobody should expect the perfect implementation with the 0 anyway.
Yeah. Well, we'll do our best.
Okay. I mean, I don't think you can predict the things like this, but I get, you think the versioning strategy for Perl 6 in general will be 6.0 is the major release, 6.1 is the next major release.
I think that's the general feeling that the major numbers would indicate breaking chains or you know some incompatibilities, but and the less one the lower numbers would indicate bug fix releases. We do have a plan for being able to emulate different versions, even if you download a later version of the code, but you declare that you're using an earlier version, it can try to emulate the previous semantics to the extent that they aren't, you know, like security holes.
Yeah.
There's other strategies for keeping the thing forward and backward compatible.
Yeah. But when you say 6.0, it's the Perl 6.0. It's not Rakuto 6.0, anything
no,
like that.
No, Rakuto actually uses version numbers that are date-based.
Right.
So you'd see 2015-01 for, today is the first, so it'd be 02. And then a sub-sequence number within that, and probably actually a git hash.
Right. It's very canonical versioning and doesn't have any meaning beyond
well,
that.
Well, you know, we're moving more toward a world where versions are kind of arbitrary. I mean, you like to know the ordering of them, but what's really important is maintaining identity. And once you've put a module or an implementation of something out there, it should really be considered an immutable object out there in the world. And if two people download the same thing and they have the same crypto hash, then you should be able to rely on the fact that these are in fact the same thing. So that's part of our strategy. We also, another part of the strategy for future-proofing is that we want to, if you have different dependencies on the same module, but on different versions of the same module, the extent that we can, we want to allow people to run two different versions of the module simultaneously. Yeah, that's hard if they have a shared resource, you know, like a database handle, but that usually means that should be factored out into yet another dependency. So if module A and module B both use module Z, but one wants version 1.2 and one wants version 1.3, as long as we keep them semantically close enough to each other and without having them interact with each other, then you can actually just load both of those in. And as long as the computer is not confused again about the identity of who is using what, then we ought to be able to keep that straight. And that's another strategy for not breaking every time someone downloads a new module.
Right. Does that mean you can load the same two different versions of the same module in the same process?
That's the hope. Yes.
Okay. So I guess that will affect how CPAN works for ProSix.
Yeah, some CPAN modules will obviously, if they aren't written well enough, you know, may or if they're relying on low-level threading primitives of Perl 5 that don't work so well, then they're obviously, you know, going to have trouble under when called from Perl 6. But the modules that are fairly well behaved, we can probably actually use the concurrency model of Perl 6 to coordinate these various Perl 5 modules in a way that Perl 5 itself could not.
Okay. Well, you briefly mentioned, but I think the original, I'm not sure if it's original, but there was this idea about running 5 and 6 in the same process and call the modules.
And we can do that now.
Okay.
Already, yeah. The inline Perl 5 module allows us to pull in modules from Perl 5 into Perl 6 and even derive Perl 6 classes from Perl 5 classes and to have you know callback interfaces if necessary. I don't know, there's still some gotchas in there, but And, you know, it's not going to be as efficient as if the modules were implemented in Perl 6 to begin with. But for problems where you can partition the work nicely into this is the things that Perl 5 is good at and these are the things that Perl 6 is good at, and there's not a lot of cross-communication, then those sorts of problems would be quite easily solved with this sort of a situation.
That was exactly like when you write code in C and call it from Perl 5 using XS, the same way you can call yes. Perl 5 code from 6.
Mm-hmm. At one point, the author of these modules was calling into inline Perl 5, and from there was calling into inline Python, which was fun. Actually, now I think he's probably got an inline Python directly for Perl 6. I could be wrong about that, but
is that a thing?
I think it's a thing.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Python has some great libraries,
right. Yeah,
and
sure.
We'd love to seal them.
Is the JVM backend for Lacudo, does it have access to like existing Java libraries?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It's even gotten easier lately because it will map overloadings that Java allows. It maps into multiple dispatch in Perl 6. So it when we first had it, you had to put the Java subsignature that gave us types as part of the name. Now you don't have to do that anymore, so you can just call it by the simple name.
Yeah, I yesterday I went to this Ruby dev room to talk about JRuby, and they talked about many JVM optimization they got for free, so that even the same JRuby code can run faster just by updating JVM and things like that.
Yes, yeah. And we certainly noticed when we first put the Recudo onto the JVM that for certain problems it would really speed up as it learned about the program.
Mm-hmm.
And the MoreVM, of course, is much younger and not as mature, but it has the same strategies for hotspot kind of optimizations and inlining and type specialization and de-optimization if necessary, but
yeah.
Speculative optimizations that usually are right, and is doing a pretty decent job with those. The JIT doesn't produce spectacularly good code yet. There's a lot of room for improvement in the actual machine code it produces, and there's various other places where we can do a lot of much better optimization. List processing is not very efficient right now, and we think we know how to fix that. And the native types, especially arrays of native types, if you take that together with the various parallel processing primitives that we make available, it should make for some spectacularly fast number crunching capabilities at some point. It should be quite easy to match to map hyperoperators into your GPU, for instance.
That's exciting. So I think this is. I think is this the first official announcement about this coming Perl 6?
It's the first time we've actually named a date. And we've always had the old joke, it'll be ready by Christmas, we just won't say which one.
Right.
And this is the first time we've actually identified a particular Christmas we're aiming for. And, you know, we may yet miss. We're of course, human, and sometimes, you know, things go wrong. But we've been tracking the convergence of the implementations with the design over a number of years, and that was, you know, really all we were concerned about was that it did converge. As long as it is convergent, then eventually it'll get there. And it just looks now like the convergence is close to fruition.
Cool. So I guess we hope to see the more progress around this year at the Yara conferences and YAPSE North America. Are you going to OSCON this year?
Planning to. I didn't make it last year because my retina fell apart in my right eye, and after surgery, they put a bubble into my eye, and I was not allowed to travel above 2,000 feet altitude. And you can't get out of California without going over 2,000 feet altitude unless you take a boat. And there weren't any boats going where I wanted to go, so I was kind of stuck there. So I didn't get to OSCON this last year for the first time. So I was kind of treating this talk today as sort of a delayed State of the Onion talk.
Right. Which you usually give at the OSCON.
Yeah, I do. But so I plan to be at OSCON, and we plan to get to, various of the APSEs as well.
Maybe.
And various other conferences too.
Right. Maybe in the one in Tokyo as well?
We've been invited to there already and are planning to go, yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
In this conference, I don't see... I mean, usually when I see you at OSCON, we also see like your sons, Louis and Aaron.
Well, my kids are all like grown up and mostly moved out of the house. Louis got through college and he's still, he came back home for a while, but, my daughters are both married and have kids, and my older son is now in his second postdoctorate. This is Aaron. He's in his second postdoctorate at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. That's like where Einstein was.
Oh.
And he's doing like black hole thermodynamics, like Stephen Hawking stuff. So we got some scary kids, actually. The girls are both spectacularly good artists, and Lewis is my programmer, and he's I had to get at least one hacker out of the bunch of them, but
yeah,
we're proud of our kids. It's Geneva actually considers Pearl to be her sister because she was born about the same time Pearl was.
that's great. Yeah. That's my personal question. What's your regular day look like?
Well, when I'm in the Pacific time zone, I usually get up and make myself some coffee. So I'm not good for much before that. And then I have to spend some time just backlogging everything that happened overnight on IRC, because development goes on around the clock. And a lot of that development happens in Europe while I'm asleep. So I spend an amount of time, and it varies. Sometimes it takes all day to get through that backlog, depending on how complicated it is and what issues arose. Sometimes I can get through it quickly and work on something else. So it's difficult to, say that I follow an exact schedule on that. I end up finishing the backlog about the time is time to eat lunch, and and then I'm old enough that once I've eaten lunch, I pretty much have to take a geezer nap, and then I get up from that, and sometimes putter around the house to fix things, and sometimes go back to backlogging and interacting with people who have questions or need direction, or who want to tell me how I'm thinking about things wrong, and we all on the channel, spend a fair amount of time helping out the newcomers, also, then various evening things, depending.
Yeah, your IRC handle is Tim Tori.
Yeah, it's not spelled like the acronym for "there's more than one way to do it," but that's the derivation of it.
Yeah,
it was actually a terrible pun when I came up with it originally, because my boss at the time, when I was working at O'Reilly and Associates, and the head of that is Tim O'Reilly, so I was toadying up to Tim. Also, the pastor of my church was named Tim, so it was sort of a double pun.
Oh.
Now I'm not, now I don't have either of those, but the nickname stuck. And it's fun, though, because sometimes on the IRC channel, someone new will come on. They don't actually know that that's my nick. And
who's this guy?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed sort of going incognito a little bit because I get an honest view of what people are actually thinking. As soon as they know it's really me, then they clam up. But the other folks on the channel know that that I like to play that game sometimes and kind of play along with it. But I'll start talking about Larry. They come in and start talking about Larry in the third person. I will too.
That'll be interesting to see if you join the channel. I will join the channel just for that.
If they listen to this podcast, then they already spoiled it.
I already revealed the identity. So, okay. Well, listener question. What's your favorite Japanese food?
Oh, my favorite Japanese food. I like sukiyaki. I like, unfortunately, I can't eat ramen because it has eggs in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you count by how often I eat it, Yoshinoya.
Okay. Your favorite Japanese food, gyudon, beef bowl.
Yeah, beef bowl. Yeah. I usually get the combo bowl, but we've been to Japan a number of times and eaten in the Yoshinoya's there. I was disappointed last time I went to try to eat at the Yoshinoya in the fish market and discovered that they are closing the fish market and moving it somewhere else. So it won't be the original Yoshinoya anymore.
Yeah, I think this happens next year or later this year.
They pretty much had it closed down when we were there last time. But
okay.
Maybe, at least they certainly weren't letting tourists in anymore.
Yeah, that's true. So if the listener wants to contribute to this Pearl 6 development and stuff like that, what's the available options? What do you recommend listeners to do?
Well, it of course depends on your interests. Some people love to do documentation and other people hate it. it's actually quite valuable if you're a newcomer to find out where the hurdles are, the difficult to understand spots. And, you know, if you fix those spots in the documentation or in how the culture works, then it's easier for the next person coming. So some people like to pioneer that sort of thing. Other people love to write tests. Those are probably the mean people. They like to break things.
Right, the test of fails.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's pretty...
It's an important thing. You know, your best tester is sometimes, for some products, your best tester is a two-year-old because they'll push the buttons in the order that nobody expected. I don't know that we have any two-year-old testers yet, but maybe we need some. And of course, there's various levels of hacking on the actual code and various cultural support roles that people have taken on. But if you want to learn Perl 6 real good and you actually want to program in it, then I'd say find something you want to do that you think it'll work nicely in Perl 6 and something that will actually motivate you. And Perl has always been about supporting people with their external motivations. If you want to write poetry in a computer language, then Perl tends to support that. If you want to write code that is very short and unreadable, we call it code golf. We support that. Though Perl 6 doesn't support it as well as Perl 5, we are not really optimizing for code golf, but some people enjoy doing that. Other people like going out to some websites where they put up lots of different tasks and problems and solve them in a particular language. And it's a lot of fun to do that in Perl. Myself, I've put a lot of solutions on a site called Rosetta Code. This is a great site if you're into comparing different languages. If you know other languages and want to know what the corresponding code in Perl or Perl 6 would look like, it's a great place to study those things. And I've had a great amount of fun over the last few years adding hundreds of entries there. And it's also been very useful because as I did that, I discovered places where the design wasn't really quite good enough.
So by posting entries to Rosetta Code, you find some points and places where it could be improved in Perl 6 and get that feedback.
We've improved a lot of things based on difficulties I had on Rosetta Code. And sometimes the language designer, they sort of look larger to me, these problems. I'm sure other people would have other problems and they would think those would have to be fixed first. So sometimes the trivial things I notice get fixed and then the important things don't get fixed. Hopefully it all balances out in the end.
But I think the Perl's motto of there's more than one way to do it still applies to Perl 6.
It certainly applies technically and also culturally. We are very interested in helping other people on many different levels, and we have an awful lot of fun.
Right.
We have something that's deeper than fun that you might call joy. So sometimes things that are not so fun have to be done, and yet. What we tell people is have the appropriate amount of fun. To debug a problem that's in the garbage collector is not fun at all. But so we say have the appropriate amount of fun, meaning negative amount of fun. we recognize that that's how one person sort of suffers on behalf of someone else. You know, vicarious suffering is the theological term, but. Or more humorously, what we say is that we torture the implementers on behalf of the users, and the implementers are actually kind of proud of the fact that they're tortured on behalf of the users. They think that's some sort of fun, and so we go with it, and it works.
Okay. Great. I'm really looking forward to the actual release of the Perl 6 by Christmas, and looking forward to playing with it. Thank you very much.
Have the appropriate amount of fun.
Yes, that's very well. Thank you very much.